Uttanapadaki. The famous son of Maharaj Uttanapada. Parama Bhagavataha. The most exalted devotee. Asmat. Our. Kula Devata. Of the family deity. Charana Aravinda. Of the lotus feet. Udakam. In the water. Iti. Thus. Yam. Which. Anusavanam. Constantly. Utkrishyamana. Being increased. Bhagavat Bhakti Yogena. By devotional service unto the Lord. Dridam. Greatly. Vijyamana Anta Hridayaha. Being softened within the core of this heart. Utkantya. By great anxiety. Vivasha. Spontaneously. Amilita. Slightly open. Lochana. Of eyes. Yugala. Hair. Kudmala. From the flower like. Vigalita. Emanating. Amala. Uncontaminated. Vashvakalaya. With tears. Avivya Javana. Being manifested. Romapulaka Kulakaha. Whose symptoms of ecstasy on the body. Aduna Api. Even now. Parama Adurena. With great reverence. Shirasa. By the head. Vipati. He bears. So translation, Dhruva Maharaj, the famous son of Maharaja Uttanapada, is known as the most exalted devotee of the Supreme Lord because of his firm determination in executing devotional service, knowing that the sacred Ganges water washes the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. Dhruva Maharaj, situated on his own planet to this very day, accepts that water on his head with great devotion. Because he constantly thinks of Krishna very devoutly within the core of his heart, he is overcome with ecstatic anxiety. Tears flow from his half-open eyes and eruptions appear on his entire body. Kimpeet Dhruva Maharaj. The famous son of Maharaja Uttanapada is known as the most exalted devotee of the Supreme Lord. Because of his firm determination in executing devotional service. Knowing that the sacred Ganges water washes the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. Dhruva Maharaj, situated on his own planet, to this very day accepts that water on his head with great devotion. Because he constantly thinks of Krishna very devoutly within the core of his heart. He is overcome with ecstatic anxiety. Tears flow from his half-open eyes. And eruptions appear on his entire body. So purport by his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. When a person is firmly fixed in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is described as vira-vrta, fully determined. Such a devotee increases his ecstasy in devotional service more and more. Thus, as soon as he remembers Lord Vishnu, his eyes fill with tears. This is a symptom of a maha-bhagavata. Dhruva Maharaj maintained himself in that devotional ecstasy, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also gave us a practical example of transcendental ecstasy when he lived at Jagannath Puri. His pastimes there are fully narrated in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So Om Ganat Tivananda Shah Gunanjana Shalakya Chakshuran Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So here to state that Dhruva Maharaj is an example of determination. In fact, that's what his name means. He's Dhruva, you know, he's very determined. So let's examine his determination, because it gives us great hope. Why does it give us great hope? Because Dhruva Maharaj's original determination was not so pure. And in the same way, frankly speaking, we are not so pure. So, as it's said in the Bhagavatam, akama sarva kama moksha kama daradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Whether one is full of material desires, free of material desires, or desires of liberation, then he should worship Krishna tivrena. Tivrena means like basically forceful, determined. It's like Dhruva, the same thing. Tivrena bhakti yogena, forceful devotional service. Not that you're forcing Krishna, but you're doing it in such a very determined way. Like you, I'll give you an example of that in Srila Prabhupada's pastimes. If you listen to some of Prabhupada's classes from the time when he first arrived in America, you know, the Bhagavad Gita classes, it's very like, you're practically bowled over by Prabhupada's forceful presentation of the Bhagavad Gita philosophy. And it's like you can also hear Prabhupada's transcendental anxiety, like is mentioned here, to save these conditioned souls, to start this mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And even if you if you see the picture of Srila Prabhupada when he took sannyas from Keshava Maharaj, you can see this like forceful, determined look on Prabhupada's face, isn't it? I mean, you see, Prabhupada took sannyas at the same time as one of his godbrothers, Sanatan, which was a very old man. I guess he looked like about 80 or 90 years old. Because nowadays in ISKCON, you have to be that old to take sannyas. I was just speaking to one of my godbrothers, he's 65, and he said, well, I'll take sannyas when I'm 75. And I said, do you think you're going to be able to do anything at that time? And he said, well, I'll try. So, but you see in Prabhupada's face, it's like he could, it's almost like he could burn to ashes the universe, basically, isn't it? And it's so like determined to carry out the order of the spiritual master. It's amazing. So let's get back to Dhruva Maharaj. So Dhruva Maharaj came from a very good family, obviously. His great-grandfather was Lord Brahma. You can't do better than that, basically, unless Krishna is your great-grandfather. And then his grandfather was Swayam Bhuvamanu, and Shatrurupa, his wife. And Swayam Bhuvamanu and Shatrurupa, they had some children, and two of the main stories told in the Bhagavatam are about their children. That's Priyavrata. That's another story told in the Bhagavatam. And then you have Uttanapada. Uttanapada, of course, is Dhruva Maharaj's father. And Uttanapada, he made one mistake. He married two ladies at the same time. As Ridhananda Maharaj is very fond of saying, sapatni means with one's wife, but it also means having more than one wife. Patnya. So you can make a play on words to say that it says if you have more than one wife, it's like having two enemies. And of course you see that to the highest extent that was exhibited in Chitraketu's pastimes. When Chitraketu had 10 million wives and only one wife had the son, and the 9,999,000 wives, 999, arranged to kill the son that was born of the one wife. So there's natural, let's say, enmity. This lust actually creates enmity. I was actually, last night we were talking that even Chanakya Pandit says that a woman who accepts another man in the presence of her children, in the presence of her son, becomes the enemy of the children. And it's very interesting how this lust ebbs. Anyway, because why is it? Because lust sort of stimulates the consciousness of I and mine, which is the basic false ego in this world, I and mine. Because you think someone is yours, and you are, you know, you're important, and someone is yours, and so that something is yours, or someone is yours, and of course this is a reflection of the spiritual realm, the pastimes of the Lord in the spiritual realm, where we say about the pure devotee, Krishna is yours, you have the power to give him. I'm simply running behind you, chanting Krishna, 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 say tuma, Krishna dite pa. Krishna say tuma, that means Krishna is yours. Krishna, Krishna, boli, I'm chanting Krishna, Krishna, running behind you. So, Krishna is the property of the pure devotee. And of course, the pure devotee is the property of Krishna. Like, if you say the Bhagavatam, sarva hridayam mayam, sarvanam viyam tvaham, maranyatena janati, naham tevyo, managapi. But Krishna says, the sadhus, because they do not know anyone else but me as theirs, I do not know anyone else but them as mine. So, then a perfect example of yayatamam, prapajante tam siddhaiva bhajamiham, as you reciprocate with Krishna, he reciprocates with you accordingly. So the pure devotee has this like intimate relationship with Krishna, where Krishna is his. You know, that's one of the aspects of pure devotional service described by Rupa Goswami, that it's the only means for controlling Krishna. You know, the devotee keeps Krishna under his control, which is something very wonderful. So in the material world, though, that is perverted by this concept of I and mine, and when you have more than one wife, it becomes exacerbated that, you know, he's mine. And of course, the men sort of like that. In the Muslim religion, they have this whole thing that when you die, you go back. Also in the Vedas, it's there. When you die and you die in the battlefield, you go back and all these apsaras. The apsaras are the, sometimes described as heavenly prostitutes, which just seems to be an oxymoron. Heavenly prostitutes. Anyway, so the prostitutes in the higher regions. And they fight for you. And the men, you know, they like that. You know, it's actually a very attractive thing for the male psychology because they're so damn self-centered that, you know, the women are fighting. He's mine, he's mine. It's like the dream of a man come true, isn't it? No, don't answer that because your wife is here. But it's like, you know, he's mine, he's mine. It's like, basically like the Beatles in the 1960s. You know, they were all screaming. And that it really puts them in Maya. The Beatles were completely in Maya in those days. They're called groupies. So anyway, so that's like a dream of someone who fights a so-called jihad, you know, and dies fighting the infidels. That he gets to have this the celestial virgins. Actually, in the Vedic literatures, they're not listed as virgins, they're listed as prostitutes. Anyway, so that's another issue. So, anyway, so Dhruva Maharaj, getting back to the story of Dhruva Maharaj, he had a mother and a stepmother. And even in the West, you hear these stories about the wicked stepmother, isn't it? You ever hear that? Cinderella and such? You know Cinderella? Even in India you hear the story. That, you know, the wicked stepmother. So, not that all stepmothers are wicked. It's not that if some of you have a stepmother you should just say, you wicked bitch. But generally they're trying to take the money. Like, take the money from your father so you won't inherit anything. So anyway, this is absolute fact. So basically, Dhruva Maharaj had a mother and a stepmother. His stepmother's name was Suruchi, which means basically good taste. Like Ruchi. Ruchi means to have a taste. So it's interesting how the people are named in these Vedic pastimes. So the good taste, that means her husband was completely entranced with her, with her beauty, or with her whatever. I mean, she wasn't really known for her personality. But at least for her beauty, he was entranced. And then, Niti, it means like, rules and regulations. I mean, someone who's actually very determined to be dharmic. Which is interesting, Suniti. Like you have Niti Shastra, which is the rules and ordinary rules and regulations. So Suniti means good. Su means good. Anyway. So, Suniti and Suruchi, they were both co-wives of Uttanapada. And Dhruva was the son of Suniti. So what happened is that Dhruva generally was not allowed on the lap of his father, Uttanapada, at least when his stepmother was around. And Uttanapada was sitting, and he had Uttama, who was Dhruva Maharaj's brother, or half-brother, let's say, was sitting on his lap, on the king's lap. And Dhruva Maharaj was attempting to climb up. He never actually got on the lap. He was actually attempting to climb up on the lap. And Suruchi, a good taste lady, it's not that she had good taste, you know, but she was more attractive. So Suruchi said, you know, you're really not qualified. You're actually not my son. I mean, only my sons can sit on your father's lap. That actually shows that you know, when you have this sort of, anyway, arrangement, that one becomes the enemy. The parent can actually become the enemy in a situation like that. So anyway, so what happened is that Dhruva Maharaj was rejected by his father. And his father didn't say anything. I mean, can you imagine a poor boy? And the father just sat there, you know, completely silent. It's amazing. I mean, how this lust can really, like, destroy one's good qualities. Avritam gyanam etena gyanino nichavarana kama rupena kuntiya dushparena lena chal. We talked about this also last night, that there are stories about ladies even killing their children when they have a paramour, because the paramour doesn't like their children for some reason. Rather, there's that one story, the famous story that actually happened in North Carolina, how a lady put her children in her car at the bank of a river and took off the handbrake or the foot brake or whatever, the emergency brake, and watches the car as slowly glided into the river or into the lake, and the car filled up with water, and she had, I think, three children, if I remember correctly, the three children, she watched them drown. Could you imagine that? You know, generally, like Prabhupada said, that the love the mother has for the children is the closest thing to love of God in this material world. But under the influence of lust, one becomes so heartless. So heartless that one can kill their own children. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's just like, huh? You got the closest thing to love of God, you know, causeless love that a mother has. I mean, just like I see with my mother, she just like frankly thinks of me day and night. You know, if I was Krishna, she'd be a pure devotee by now. So, but, isn't it? Anyway, it's just like, I mean, that's natural, the mother's love. I'm not decrying it or criticizing it. It's just part of life. like a cow, and all the species of life, it happens to be like that. So, not all. I mean, actually, sometimes in the fishes, the fish ladies eat the children. But at least the higher species. So, I mean, it's pretty hellish. So anyway, because of lust, Ruchi sort of treated Dhruva Maharaj badly, and she said to him, good instructions. She was angry, lusty, but she said some good instructions. She said, actually, if you want to sit on my on your father's lap, you have to take birth from my womb. And if you really want that, you've got to worship Lord Vishnu. And then he went crying, obviously. He's a little kid, 5 years old. He went crying to his mother. And first thing his mother said was very interesting. This is really why she's called Suniti. She said, you should not wish ill for anybody. Because generally, if someone does something to hurt us, we become angry at them, isn't it? It's interesting. We become angry at them, but it's actually not them who did that. It's actually Krishna arranging that for us. In the Bhagavatam, the first canto, it says, he who blames the immediate perpetrator of an act is just as culpable for that act as the person who did it. It was interesting. Because it's actually Krishna. So I was talking to some devotees yesterday, and said that if someone does something that aggravates you, instead of getting angry with them, you should understand it's really not between you and them, it's between you and Krishna. And as far as their situation, it's between them and Krishna. It has nothing to do really with your relationship with them or their relationship with you. Because it's really Krishna putting you through a test, or Krishna putting you in a situation for purification. I mean, that's how Dharma the bull saw it when he was being hit by the personality of Kali. He thought, this is Krishna. Of course, first he said to Pariksit Maharaj, when Pariksit Maharaj asked him who has done this, he said it's very difficult to ascertain. But then ultimately the conclusion was it's the action of Krishna's energies under the direction of Krishna. So there's a reason for that. So really, when someone attacks us or aggravates us or is not sweet to us or speaks some harsh words, we should think that's Krishna. It's between us and Krishna that we have to think about. It's not them anymore. Remember that. So Dhruva Maharaj's mother, Suniti, said, you should not wish ill of anybody. It's interesting. That was her first response to Dhruva Maharaj's complaint, giving him some good instruction, rather than, so-and-so, B-I-T-C-H. Isn't it? I mean, that's how normally people would respond. I don't want to use that word in class. I'm just spelling it. This so-and-so. I just hate her guts. That's how we usually respond. I mean, sometimes I'm even driving with someone, he's driving the car, and someone just does something that he doesn't like, and anger comes up. I hate him. I said, why do you hate him? You've never met him before, You just hate him because he interfered with your sense gratification. Of course, that's the statement of the Gita, that, from contemplating the objects of the sense. It was funny. And then a few minutes later, he did the same thing. The person who was driving my car, he did the same thing. I said, how come you hated him for doing that? And when you did it, you think it's all right? He said, because I'm me. that's self-centeredness, isn't it? It's interesting how, you do exactly the same thing and it's all right, and someone else does it and they're a demon. I mean, it's interesting devotees use this word. Anybody, disturbs them while they're driving or does anything, they're a demon. Or like if I'm online in the airport, I hope these demons get finished first so I can get to the ticket counter. And what does that have to do with devotional service? If they're you know, we have to, it's just like calling people demons is another just way of expressing our false ego. Because it means that we think that I think I'm better than you. Isn't it? You know, we have this whole concept that of I and mine, I'm much better, I'm much more important, so we get the devotional language to express that in and say that you're a demon. So anyway, so getting back to the story. So Suniti actually was very Krishna conscious. I mean, completely Krishna conscious. She still had her emotions, of course. She was crying to see her son crying and everything like that. And she said to her, Dhruva Maharaj, that you actually got some good instruction from your stepmother. She had the clarity of mind to say that. And Dhruva Maharaj, you know, just actually worshipping Lord Vishnu, you can accomplish whatever you want. And then Dhruva Maharaj said, where is that Lord Vishnu? And his mother said, I've heard by the grapevine that he's in the forest. Now, of course, Lord Vishnu is everywhere. But in those days, when someone wanted to worship the Lord, they would go to the forest. And that's called Aranyaka. Like the word Aranya means forest. Aranyaka means one who lives in the forest. That statement by Chanaka Pandit, Aranya Tena Ganpavyam Yata Aranyam Yata Graham, that if your house is not pleasant, then you should head for the forest. Because at least you're living with wild animals in the forest, there's some spiritual benefit. So, anyway, so then Dhruva Maharaj heard that, and he left in the middle of the night when his mother wasn't watching. Obviously, his mother didn't say, go to the forest to him, because he was only 5 years old. He was so determined in his pursuit of his objective that he went to the forest. And he didn't know what to do in the beginning. And then, of course, Narada Muni meets him. And Narada Muni says, and this shows Dhruva Maharaj's determination. He says, you know, you're only 5 years old and you're attached to, you know, games and playful things that children are attached to. So go back home, you know. When you get older, you can think about this. But you got your whole life to live. Your whole life to live. Of course, this is somewhat similar to Prahlad Maharaj's friends' objections to his preaching of Krishna consciousness. They said, you know, we have our whole life, we're just kids. And of course he responded, Komaracharit Pragyo Dharmam Bhagavatam Niha. One should take up devotional service from the very beginning, because you'll always have an excuse not to be Krishna conscious. Yeah, there's always going to be an excuse. You know, we're just kids, we're just young men and women, we're in love, we're just engaged in economic development, we're just retired, you know, or we're just sleeping. You know, we have to sleep 10, 12, 15 hours a day just to be happy. I'm just joking. So, anyway, there's so many excuses. So it's very similar. So Dhruva Maharaj said, when Narada Muni said, go back home, little boy, he said, no, I want some instructions. And he got instructions from Narada Muni to meditate on the form of the Lord at the same time thinking of his desire. Narada Muni didn't say, give up your desire, which is interesting. Because Narada Muni understood, as Krishna states in the Gita, that chaturvidha bhajanti mam, people come to Krishna for the four reasons, and you don't want to artificially take away those reasons, because that's their impetus in the beginning. They come because they want wealth, they become because they're inquisitive, they come because they want knowledge, or because they're in distress. So Dhruva Maharaj's desire was pretty intense. I mean, he wanted a kingdom greater than that of Lord Brahma, his great-grandfather. So that's, you know, wealth, position, and he's also in distress. I mean, it's not that you just have one of the four things. You can have three or even four of the four reasons for coming to Krishna consciousness. I mean, many people in the movement came just because they liked the taste of the prasadam. So there's all sorts of different reasons why people come to Krishna consciousness. And some, in the early days, some people came just because they were taking intoxication. They woke up the next morning in the Hare Krishna temple. That actually happened, like San Francisco and places like that. So, anyway, so Dhruva Maharaj, he was very determined. And he went to this, he actually went to Vrindavan, in Braj. There's this place called, Dhruva Tila. Anyone's been to Dhruva Tila here? You've been to Dhruva Tila. Tila means like a hill. So it's a hill that he meditated on. And you can actually visit this place. There's actually a little deity of Dhruva Maharaj there on the hill. A beautiful place in Braj. Many of the great personalities meditate. I mean, there's a place for Lord Kapiladev in Braj. And you find many, many of these great sages, they would go to Braj to meditate. So anyway, so Dhruva Tila, and he was so determined. I mean, a little boy, little children generally have a lot of difficulty controlling their tongue as far as the eating process. I mean, they just like candy and ice cream and everything, even they, though they know it hurts them. You know, there's just not the logical brain hasn't been developed at that particular point. But Dhruva Maharaj, even in the beginning, he just performed these really harsh austerities. After 3 days, he ate some berries. And then after some time, then he went to the austerity. After 6 days, he would just eat some dried leaves. And then after 9 days, the third austerity, the third month, after every 9 days, he would just take a sip of water. And then after, what was it, 12 days or something like that, he would breathe. You know, each month he would increase the austerities. And of course he was chanting the mantra, meditating on the form of the Lord that he had been instructed to do by Sripad Narada Muni. But he performing all these really heavy, and that shows such great determination to achieve his goal. So he's very much, the point I'm making is that he was very much goal-oriented. Mm. This really is important insofar as keeping one alive, even. We were making this point in regard to this person, Viktor Frankl's work. Mm. He had one book about man's search for meaning. And it talks about his experiences in the concentration camp, and it talks about how when people had this goal, they were able to survive the horrendous conditions in the concentration camp. I mean, can you imagine how horrendous the people were actually made to work in snow without any shoes? And if they had shoes, they were ill-fitting, you know. And the only way they would get shoes or boots sometimes is they'd steal them from the, or take them from the dead bodies of the corpses of the people who died. You know, we're so soft here. We're like the princess in the pea. But can you imagine such a situation? Because they had a purpose. His analysis was that because people had a purpose, they survived such horrendous conditions. So not only survived, and actually you see, I was also studying about this thing called the placebo effect. When people have a purpose in life, they're able to more easily overcome different diseases, like, you know, serious diseases. When people have like a purpose in life, that's part of the placebo effect. Not only that someone gives you a pill and says it's a great medicine when it's sugar, but that you're actually feeling that you have a purpose, a reason to go on living. Because without that, no medicine's going to help you. So Dhruva Maharaj had this purpose. And it was certainly a purpose in the mode of passion, I guess mixed with ignorance. You know, because passion, because it was he wanted to acquire something. And mixed with ignorance, we can say, because he wanted to do better than someone else. You know, it's one thing to want something, but to show someone and give someone a lesson because I'm going to be better than you, that's ignorance. You understand? Because there's nothing to be gained from it. It's just like, it's anger. It's out of anger. So, you know, his motivation, he had anger, and he had intense desire. So it was sort of a mixed passion and ignorance. He even states that to Narada Muni. He says, you know, I'm just overcome with ignorance. You have to realize, Gurudev, you got to give me an appropriate instruction. You know, your instruction to go back home and, you know, be peaceful, you know, I can't do it. So it's also, it shows that he was honest with his guru. You know, instead of just like blindly saying, yes, Gurudev, but not following the instructions, he said, Gurudev, I can't do it. Like Prabhupada said, went to the devotees in the beginning, chant 64 rounds, and the devotees honestly said, can't do it. And Prabhupada reduced to 16, he said, no less. So, anyway, so Dhruva Maharaj is very determined, and well, ultimately when he saw Krishna, by the time he saw Krishna, he became completely purified, because when one meditates on the form of the Lord, no matter what motivation one has, one does get purified. If one follows the order of the spiritual master, one does become purified. Of course, Kamsa was meditating on Krishna, but he didn't get purified because he wasn't following the order of the guru. But the guru will adjust things according to one's psychophysical nature so that one is enthusiastic in devotional service. So, what is that? So for us, that means that we have to have some overriding purpose in life. And then we'll be able to do amazing things, like we see with Prabhupada. His overriding purpose is what? To serve the order of his spiritual master. And that was his mission, to satisfy his spiritual master, serve the order of his spiritual master. And in order to accomplish that, you can even look at in terms of, you know, mission statements, strategic mission statements, like planning like that. And so in order to accomplish that, he preached Krishna consciousness, came to the Western world. So that's, Prabhupada's our perfect exemplar of this particular point. He's our Dhruva Maharaj, you know, very, very determined. Of course, his determination was always transcendental goodness. It wasn't mixed. But his determination is something that we can learn from. You know, what is our purpose in life? And if we fix the order of the spiritual master, the order of Srila Prabhupada is our purpose, then we can do amazing things like Dhruva Maharaj. I mean, nobody's asking you to live on leaves every 6 days or something like that. But at least amazing things at any age, like Prabhupada did. I mean, at a ripe old age, you know, he did amazing things because he was fixed. So any questions or comments about this? We got about half a minute left of class. Questions, comments? And you tolerate so many things. Dhruva Maharaj tolerated. Obviously, his body and his mind were, you know, his body was hungry. I mean, he's a little kid, but he tolerated it. Vacho vegam, manasa krodha vegam. Jiva vegam, guru vashta vegam. Because he had this purpose.
I was reading Lord Prabhupada's book last night about the daughter of Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said that when he was
this.